impedance tells us the ratio of voltage and current, but this time in the line. So it's actually inside the line, the coax cable. to experience a mechanical, what is that? Analogy of characteristic impedance. All right, it tells you you could get a small diameter coffee stir and a large diameter drinking straw. I'll just repeat that. Get a small diameter coffee stirrer, you know, the thing that you use to stir coffee, and a large diameter drinking straw. Blow a short, sharp puff of air through each. Even though you blow equally hard into each, which is the voltage, you get only a little air through the small tube, which is the current, but a lot of air gets through the large one. The small tube has a higher characteristic impedance to pressure waves. Well, it makes sense. I guess you could see that when you use your garden hose and you get a kink in the line in your garden hose and you see what your water pressure is, it drops. And you say, okay, what's wrong with my water? I'm not getting much water. And then you check your line, your garden hose, you see there's a bump in it. Same thing, by the way, same thing with coax cable. You can get an impedance bump at any point. And you can see what I'm talking about, the way I'm describing it. So they show a figure here. Actually, I'm going too ahead of myself to experience. Okay, so that was that's a physical thing you could do if you want to, you know, get an idea of what impedance looks like between voltage and current.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I'm not going to go to a 7-Eleven now and buy some drinking straws and some coffee stirrers, but I may do that tomorrow. All right, so back to RF. This is what they say. If power flowing in a feed line encounters some impedance other than your ZO, your impedance of the line, such as a different type of feed line, the voltage and current change abruptly, or I should say the voltage and current change abruptly at the junction. So in other words, you're now transferring one impedance line to another impedance line, and at that point your voltage and current changes abruptly at that junction where they meet. That's what this is saying. To create this change, the initial wave splits into two. One in the new feed line and one reflected back towards the source in the original feed line. Okay? Just like water waves reflecting from a wall or rock, a pattern of interference is created between the incoming forward wave and the reflected wave. All right, let me just let it drop.
Indicator 2NSK, just a real quick moment. Just tell me, what does the word impedance mean, okay? I've been following you every week. I'm hanging in there. It's above my head, but I'm learning. But just tell me impedance.
Okay, it's a good question, because I'm trying to learn also. Yeah, very good, man. Hello to you, Sam. Just like resistance, this is my answer to the question, and maybe somebody else has a better explanation. Just like in DC circuits, resistance is to DC, impedance is the same, but for AC circuits, for alternating waves, for AC waves, where you have a sine wave, you know, where your voltage is rising and falling and rising and falling. Any opposition to that is called impedance, by definition, as opposed to DC, which is any opposition to DC is just called resistance. That's my understanding of all the things that I've read. Sam, back to you, and then anybody else have any further explanation. Sam first.
Yeah, Andy, thank you very much. I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'm sorry. And you're doing a really good job, and I'm really learning. After the lesson, I look up things on the computer. Continue on. Now, I understand, because I know direct current is straight. The voltage goes straight. But the impedance part, basically, is more for the alternating circuit. Okay, continue.
WB2EAV.
Yeah, I knew Ed would say something. Go ahead, Ed. How you doing?
All right, let's start with resistance. You put together a network of resistors. However you arrange the resistors, there always will be a net resulting resistance. Now, let's take an AC circuit with resistors, capacitors, and inductors. Impedance for a resistor is exactly the resistance. The impedance for an inductor or a capacitor varies with frequency, and so it's kind of sort of like a semi-resistance, and they made up the name impedance for that. Now, every network, you put together a whole pile of resistors, inductors, capacitors, whatever you want, at a specific frequency, you can measure it and find it has a resistive part and a so-called imaginary or phase-shifted part, which is like resistance or capacitance. You know, and it, there's a real and imaginary parts of an impedance, but every network will have a real part and an imaginary part, which is typically plus for inductance and minus for capacitance. So far, so good?
Yep, in my book, yes. Yeah, the only thing is I just didn't want to get too deep because you can start talking about the capacitive reactants, and that's measured in ohms, and inductive reactants in ohms, and so on, with all the different, all the formulas. But basically, I just answered Sam's, you know, direct question, the difference between impedance or what the definition of impedance is. So it's, so again, you know, in my definition, it's basically it's resistance to an AC signal becomes impedance. But it gets complicated, like you say. Ed?
The problem is it's very hard to get into this stuff without getting into, let's just say, higher than high school level math.
Yeah, but I don't want to go there because it gets too, as I said, it gets too complicated. All right, let me just lead up to this whole article in the first place, because this is all about matching impedance matching with transmission lines. So let me move on with that.
WS2N.
Okay, yeah, Paul. Good evening to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, I thought Sam was looking like for the basic idea of what it would be. So going back to your analogy with the straws, if you were blowing pushing water through the straw, you know, whatever resistance in within that straw, you know, that would be the resistance. But suppose somebody was at the other end blowing water back in the opposite direction to some degree, you know, just push, you know, not, doesn't have to be a lot, but then back. So now you have the straw, and now you got the resistance of somebody pushing back on you. And so collectively they call that impedance. So that's why, I thought Sam was looking for something like that. Back to you, Andy, WS2N.
You're doing good. I didn't mean to disrupt your whole train of thought, and I swear I did. I just wanted to be on track. I'm clear.
No, it's okay, because it's good to ask questions, because, you know, that's how we learn. You doubled with Ed. Ed, a little bit. Paul, thank you. Yeah, that's... Well, that's what happens when you get, you know, what is a standing wave? is in a standing wave, a reflected wave that's going in the opposite direction from the forward wave at the same time. If you got a forward wave going forward and you got a reflected wave coming back, because you got a mismatch somewhere, and where they meet, what happens? That's an interesting point, you know, where the signals meet. I think it gets into a little bit of that in this article. So let me just see, because I want to continue here with the article itself. Ed, you doubled with Sam, and Ed, so what did you say, Ed, before?
I said Paul's metaphor doesn't give me a warm, fuzzy feeling, but it does sound like a sure way to get a spoonful of water.
I didn't get the last part, full of water, what you said. Okay. All right. All right, let's move on here. Because, as I say, I'm a little bit pressed for time with my work environment coming up. So I said before, let me just see. I'm going to repeat this paragraph because I didn't actually finish the paragraph. So getting back to the RF, and here it is. If power flowing in a feed line encounters some impedance other than what the characteristic impedance of the line is, you know, such as a different type of feed line, the voltage and current changes abruptly at the junction. To create this change, an initial wave, or the initial wave, splits into two, one in the new feed line and one reflected back from the original feed line towards the source in the original feed line. Okay, I sort of repeated myself there. Just like water waves reflecting from a wall or rock, a pattern of interference is created between the incoming forward wave and the reflected wave. Okay, even that's where I ended before Sam's question. Even though both waves are moving, the voltage and current interference patterns are stationary, and that is called a standing wave. The standing wave ratio, which is SWR, is the ratio of the maximum to minimum voltage or current in the pattern. And see the sidebar explaining SWR in black and white. There is a little sub-article here. If anybody's interested, it says, for a terrific visual explanation of what SWR is and how standing waves are created in a feed line, watch the video, Similarities in Wave Behavior, in the AT&T archives on YouTube.com. So if you go to YouTube.com and go to AT&T archives, and you can then see a visual explanation of what SWR is and how it's created. So they show this is a little sidebar that they're adding. If anybody wants to actually see what that looks like. Okay, so moving forward, let me let it drop.
Hang on, Andy, one second.
Yes, go and go to the sidebar. It'll be interesting to see.
No, is this the video that I saw a couple of years ago? It was done 1950s. It's blurry and graying. If that's the one, it is absolutely fantastic. It uses all kinds of commonly occurring things with vibrating stuff and the like to make analogies to SWR and things like that. It is fantastic. It really brings it home into things you can really understand.
T2FIU, to Shive.
Okay, we had a double there. We had FIU and someone else underneath. Okay. Just to answer your question, Ed, I think I saw this one. I believe it's in black and white, not color. And it goes, like you say, it goes back to the 50s and 60s. It's an old video, if it's the same one that he's referring to. I'm going to have to look at this one, which I did not do and see. So, all right. Thanks, Ed. Let me just move on because we had KD2FIU, go ahead, you have a question, and then there was someone else after you. Go ahead, George.
Thank you, Andy. Great presentation, and including in the pictorials of that is the water standing in the pond and actually reflecting backward multiple times along the transmission line. That's all I could say, if anybody could picture that. Thank you, Andy, very much. KD2FIU clear.
Okay, very good. I did not look at the article, which I should have looked, but I just didn't do it for whatever reason. All right, thanks. I will see it. The other station that doubled with George, please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That was WA2VDH. Yes, that video on ATT Archives, that's by Dr. Shive, Similarities of Wave Behavior. It is a beautiful video, excellent video. Seen it a couple of times. Excellent.
Let me clarify. It's horrible quality, but absolutely magnificent content.
Okay. Yeah, hello, VDH, I forgot, is it John? I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Is it John? Excuse me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, WA2VDH, yeah, it's John. Good.
Okay. As I said, my memory is not that quick. All right, very good. And I think it's the one that I saw a long time ago. So I'll have to look at that again. Okay, very good. I'm happy that I mentioned this, because it's good. All right, so let me move on here. All right, so hams, it says here, hams are counseled to minimize SWR, which is true. Are we all in the same boat? Do we want to get the lowest SWR we can, get both the maximum efficiency and the maximum signal to our antennas? And that's because Denny waves created by the reflected power have higher peak voltages, increasing dielectric loss. That's interesting. I'm learning too as I go along with this, so bear with me. And higher peak currents increasing resistive loss. So it says here higher peak voltages will increase your dielectric loss and higher peak currents will increase your resistive loss. Feed line loss in general is dissipation of the RF signal as heat by any means. Dielectric loss occurs in the insulation between the center conductor and shield, caused by the AC voltage between the conductors. Resistive loss is caused by the resistance of the center conductor, which makes sense, and shield to AC current, and is proportional to the square of the current. As frequency increases, so do both dielectric and resistive losses. And I mentioned that in the articles that I've been talking about in the past about dielectric losses and resistive losses and coax cable. So this is his explanation of it. All right, let me let it drop. Any questions? WA2CDO. Okay, good. We got a tentative audience out there. All right. So in addition, and again, I'm just reading this word by word from the QSD article. So eventually, Ward's going to talk about what they actually do, what we do to match impedances. He's just giving an overview now of what goes on in the actual line itself, the coax cable line. So, in addition, after the reflected power makes its way back to the source, such as a transmitter, it can be reflected again, heading back to the load or the antenna. Each unwanted extra trip through the feed line results in loss until all of the power is either transferred to the load or dissipated as heat. And I guess an example, I'm going to add this in, I've seen where a transmitter is putting out, let's say, 10 watts of power, and I know it's into a 50 ohm load. I connect it up to my antenna. on my feed line to the antenna, which is, let's say, unknown impedance. I look at my solar power, I see it's a lot higher. I say, where did the extra power come from? Why is it showing me like 15 watts instead of 10 watts? I would believe that's the reflected power coming back and adding to, instantaneously adding to the peaks of the forward power and the peaks of the reflected power are additive and is giving me a total power, which is a higher power number. And this is on a broad watt meter. I've seen that many times. As a question to the audience out there, has anyone else experienced this, what I'm just explaining? I'll just stand by.
All the time.
It has to happen.
Okay, that's a good answer. All the time, and it has to happen. That's right. So, you may scratch your head, and if you don't, thinking about why am I seeing a higher power, if you don't understand why it's occurring, you may think that there's something wrong with your transmitter, that I'm not really putting out the proper power because I'm seeing more power than what I'm supposed to see. So it can throw somebody off if they don't understand what's going on, and this is the explanation. Okay, any questions regarding this?
NGWB2AB.
Yeah, go ahead, Ed.
You are actually measuring with an SWR bridge the voltage standing wave ratio. And I think because of changing impedances, your voltage tends to go up. So basically, when you have a large mismatch, it is not telling you power. It's telling you a distorted version of power, and that's what we see.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly, because that's what a bird watt meter does. It measures the VSWR, and I always refer it to VSWR as opposed to ISWR, I meaning current, or CSWR. I never see that. I always see VSWR. So it's a voltage. It's a voltage ratio. So when the voltages add, that's what I see. And that's right. It's actually a distorted. What's the word I'm thinking of? The result is a distorted voltage that's causing the voltage to be higher. So that's right. Okay. Any other questions before I move on? All right. Very good. We're moving here. Moving forward. Let's see. I'm just reading it here just so I get myself caught up. Alright, minimizing reflectance. Okay, so what I just said, I'll just repeat the last paragraph. So in addition, after the reflected power makes its way back to the source, such as the transmitter, it can be reflected again, heading back to the load of the antenna. Each unwanted extra trip through the feed line results in loss, until all the power is either transferred to the load or dissipated as heat. To avoid this, we try to match the line and load impedances, minimizing reflections and SWR. Okay, so that's what we try to do. We want to match as best as we can to minimize these losses, which will increase the efficiency and get more power to the antenna. And the more power to the antenna, the higher signal we will have at the other end, hopefully. Okay. Let me let it drop. So it says here, inefficient power transfer into a receiving system due to a large impedance mismatch can also reduce receive sensitivity or decrease signal-to-noise ratio. As mentioned in the previous article, about impedance matching circuits, and that was the actual article which I didn't read. The reflected waves at a transmitter combined with the transmitter's output, creating an impedance that might not be what the transmitter was designed to drive. So, there are ways to use the feed lines themselves to alter impedances so they match, or at least minimize the effects of the mismatch. Okay, so that's what this article's about. So there are ways, and again, he says there are ways of, to use feed lines themselves to alter the impedances so that they match, or at least minimize the match, minimize the effects of the mismatch. Okay, so the next paragraph will talk about that. Any other questions up to this point? W-H-2-CDO.
Any comments?
Yeah, go ahead. Comment all you want. Two.
I really don't want to go into a Smith chart, but let me tell you the following. A Smith chart will show you that if you have an impedance, if you have a visuar, as you add transmission line, you're going in a circle around the Smith chart where the impedances are all over the place, but the SW, it always works out that the SWR remains the same. At one point, you'll have highly capacitive. Let's say you start at 100 ohms, pure resistance, SWR 2 to 1. As you add line, you are around the circle on the Smith chart, then you go to some ridiculous complex thing with the same SWR, 2 to 1. It remains the same. But often, like you can convert it to a simple resistance with a series inductance or capacitance that you can resonate out. So by playing this game allows you to take shortcuts with tuning it out instead of a random arbitrary thing that you're not really sure where you start with. You can bring it to where you know how to fix it.
Yes, I'm visualizing the way you're describing it, because I've seen Smith charts and I've seen the curves and what you could do if you you change your impedance, you change feed lines, you minimize reflections. I did it when I worked at AIL, by the way, when I worked in the microwave section. Only I did it under a microscope on strip lines using not strip lines, microstrip circuits on an amplifier where we had to measure the, we had it connected to a an SWR meter and a network analyzer, of course, and looking at the network analyzer, you can see the different impedances, we see the impedance changes as you, I took little pieces of gold and I placed the gold with a non-conductive tweezer onto the microstrip line itself, and I moved it around, and you can see things change, and then you get it exactly where you want it on the network analyzer, and then you lock it down at that point. I forget what I applied to it, which would keep it in that position, and then let me leave it there. So you've probably seen what I'm talking about. Okay, good. All right, let me just, we're going to get into synchronous transformers, which is what this article mainly is about. This is the heart of the article. So let me just ask any other questions at this point? Okay, good. It's WA2CDL, and you're listening to Andy's Corner. So, synchronous transformers. The most common use of transmission lines in impedance matching are the synchronous transformers, which he says are special lengths of feed line connected in series between an impedance to be matched at one end of the line. The impedance of the load and the desired impedance at the other end, which is the input impedance, which is Z sub in, parentheses, Z sub in, which is the input impedance. Synchronous means the reflections generated at the connections of the feed lines synchronize the, or add together to create the desired impedance to the input of the matching section. And unfortunately, they show some diagrams of what it looks like. Two types are shown in figure one, where you can actually... you can see a certain length. You see a certain length of a transmission line, any length. And then you see a quarter wave transformer which has a formula attached to it, which is the, this, as I said, is a quarter wave transformer. LQ equals a quarter wave. This is, which has a certain impedance. It's a different impedance, a different characteristic impedance line that's connected to a transmission line of any length at one end, and connected to, again, a transmission line of any length at the other end. So that's your quarter wave transformer, pictorial, which I'm trying to describe. It's not easy to describe it, but I'm trying to do it. So, again, I'm trying to stay away from the mass. But again, you know, keep in mind, folks, this article is an overview of how to use transmission lines to match impedances. So if you want to get into the nitty-gritty and into the depth, then you can read the article or see articles on what formulas to use to figure out the lengths of the lines and the type of lines, the type of impedance matched the lines. In other words, 50 ohm or 75 ohm or 62 ohm, or what kind of line you would use to match the impedances. So with that, let me just let it drop and I'll continue. WA2CDL. Okay, so it gets a little bit hairy from this point on a little bit, but I'll continue. The most common example is what they call the quarter wave or Q section, which uses a quarter wavelength of feed line with an impedance, and it's a little formula, which is the square root of the impedance of the load times the impedance of the input impedance. So you have the input impedance of the transmission line multiplied by the impedance of the load, take the square root of that, and that's your quarter wave feed line formula for a Q section. A Q section is often used to convert the approximate 100 ohm impedance of a full wave loop into 50 ohms. So he's using that as an example. So what you're doing is you're taking a 100 ohm impedance and you're dropping it down to 50 ohms. In this case, the transformer section must have, and again, use the same formula, which is the square root of 100 times 50 equals 70.7 ohms. That's what it comes out to. So RG59, RG11, or any 75 ohm hard line are popular choices. So what you want to use now is you want to use that particular type of a coax cable with that impedance to do the matching. Because you want to match 100 to 50 ohms, you use that that coax cable. Let me let it drop.
Another comment, Danzy.
Stay away from the bath.
Oh, absolutely. This is an absolutely magnificent idea with one major flaw. You really can only buy coax lines in 50, 75, or I think 93 ohms. To use this technique effectively, you have to be able to put together a coax line of whatever impedance seems to work in this case, but you only have a limited repertoire to choose from.
Okay, you forgot there's also a 62 ohm cable. I believe, where do they use 62 ohms? Does anybody know? I keep thinking it's the cable in your house. Your cable in your house is not 50 ohms, we know that. No, it's actually 75 ohms, I believe. But I'm thinking back, where did I see 62, maybe 62 and a half ohm cable, and I forget the RG number for it. You can look that up. But there is a 62 ohm cable, Ed, just to let you know.
VDH with a comment.
Okay, I gotta remember to wait for the beep. Yes, John, go ahead.
Yeah, the quarter-wave transformer is really most useful for strip line, because then you can control the impedance of the strip line. You can come up with pretty much anything you want. So it's really most effective with strip line.
Amen, brother.
Yeah, and that's right. That's interesting too. Because he refers this particular cable, I think he's just using this as an example to make it easier to understand. But yes, stiff line makes sense because I've seen that before. Although he's talking about what's he talking about? RG-59. RG-11 or any 75 ohm or hard line. So you're right about that. Anything else, John?
Oh, the other thing is that you can only match resistance to resistance.
Hey, that's true too, yes. Okay, continuing here. As I say, I'm going through this myself for the first time. 75 hard line are popular choices. That's what I just mentioned. Okay, one set of reflections is created at the connection of the Q section to the antenna's feed point, and the other at the connection to the 50 ohm line, feed line. The reflections all add together such that the antenna feed point is connected where the impedance is 100 ohms, and the main feed, 50 ohm feed line, is connected at the 50 ohm impedance point. Now I got to understand the way he's describing this because it sounds a little obscure to me. The way Ward is explaining this, I don't really like his explanation because it's not that straightforward. But again, I'm just reading what he said. Anti-reflection coatings on lenses use the same principle of quarter-wave coatings to cancel reflections that cause glare. And that's interesting. Okay. He's referring to lenses all of a sudden. Alright, let me let it drop.
Yeah, comment on the lenses.
Yeah, optics, that's a whole interesting story. It's another baby to talk about. Although it's not my expertise. Go ahead.
Yeah, this is the reason why fine optical lenses have that reddish, bluish, hazy look to them, because they mismatch at the red end and they mismatch at the blue end, but they only match in the middle of the optical spectrum. So you get that reddish, bluish, hazy glow, hazy look to a fine lens.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I've ever seen that. I'm thinking, where have I seen it, if I ever did? That's, okay, and that's, yeah, an interesting result. But, I haven't seen it anywhere where I've done any experiments with it. So I'm just thinking about what you said.
Yeah, if you take a look at your camera lens, hold it so that you get a reflection off the lens, and you'll see it has like a bluish, reddish tint to it. Because that's where it's mismatching at the red end, and it mismatches at the blue end. It's only really a quarter wave, like in the middle of the optical range, so it sort of tends to have a little mismatch at each end of the optical spectrum.
You're talking about when you say camera lens. So when I look at the lens itself, look into the camera lens, and I can see, oh yeah, you know something, you're right. I just realized, that's right, I've seen that. You got to look at it at a certain angle and you can notice it. Is that what you're talking about? Because I remember seeing something similar to what you're saying.
Yeah, it has like a hazy, bluish-reddish tint to the reflection that does come off the lens.
Right. I have seen that, yes. I just didn't have to think where I've seen that phenomenon. Okay, very good. Thank you for that. All right, it's getting late for me. I'm going to end because it's a lot of stuff to absorb. I'm not going to go into transmission line stubs, which is the next number of paragraphs. But I'll just finish this up. I got just two more paragraphs to do, and then we can wrap it up for today. But we'll continue next week. So before I do that, any other quick questions?
A very quick comment, Andy.
Yeah, go ahead.
Pauline from AIL years ago says hello.
Really? I remember her. We'll have to talk about this.
Yeah, some other time. I don't want to take TechNet time.
Wow. We're talking about the 80s. Okay. Pauline. Okay, good. Thank you. All right, any other quick questions? Because then I'm going to wrap this up. All right. I hope I didn't go too far over everybody's heads, like my own. But, you know, I'm learning also as I go along. So we're all in the same boat, like another net that I know about. All right. The quarter wave section, again, they're referring to some figures here, so you're going to have to bear with me. The quarter wave section in figure one helps amateurs make good use of all that 75-ohm hardline originally used for cable TV systems. Okay, Dick has spoken about that many times. Anytime you see that hardline being thrown out for cable TV, you know, grab it. For example, by placing a quarter wave, by placing a 1/12 wave transformer, that's interesting, 1/12 wave, transformer at the antenna and at the transceiver, a long run of inexpensive, low-loss 75 hardline can be used without raising the SWR for antennas and transmission and transceivers designed for a 50-ohm system. So, you take your 75, what are you saying? You take your 75-ohm hardline, okay, and place a 1/12 wavelength transmission line at the antenna and at the transceiver, at both ends. So at the frequency, take 1/12 wavelength, you can measure the length of 1/12, take that transmission line and add it to both ends of your 75-ohm cable, and now you're matching to 50 ohms. So, what they call a synchronous transformer. Interesting. So, synchronous transformers depend on the electrical length of the feed line being a particular fraction of a wavelength long. These are single-band transformers, unlike broadband ferrite transformers, for example. The greater the difference between the two impedances, the narrower the bandwidth of the match will be. Nevertheless, performance is generally acceptable over a single amateur band. The transformer section, which is again referred to as the impedance ZO, and the impedance of the load can vary up to 10% or so and still give acceptable results. Okay, that's it. End of discussion for today. It's a lot to absorb. And we can go over this again. Because sometimes I have to go over it a couple of times so it sinks in. Any final questions? Because then I got to get out of here. I got to get ready for work. This is Andy's Quarter, WH.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Quick comment.
Yeah, I don't know if that was you, because it timed out just as I was giving it back. So somebody was transmitting. I didn't let the timer reset, besides myself. Yeah, Ed, go ahead.
Although I don't think anybody is going to try what you're talking about at home, just remember, radio waves travel through coax at roughly 2/3 of the speed they travel through a vacuum. So that would affect the cable length for a particular, number of wavelengths at a particular frequency.
Yeah, I mean, you have a thing called velocity factor, and it's less than one, it's point something. I think the velocity factor for RG8 cable is 0.66, if I'm not mistaken. It's coming up with that number, that point. 66%, I believe. Yes, of course, you got to take that into consideration when you're going to measure the wavelength of the cable. That's for sure. That's a given. I can add that in. I don't know if he, I don't know why he doesn't mention that. Maybe he did in an earlier article, but he didn't hear. But good point. Okay, thanks. Before I go, any other questions?
Andy, KDQFIU, I got to talk to you about this. I've done experiments with this. I know exactly what you're talking about. It has to do with velocity factor, the quality of the cable, all of that. I've worked with it. We'll talk about it another time. Great show, man. KDQFIU, over to you.
Okay, thank you. Well, again, you know, this is a discussion and some information that people hopefully can understand, including myself. But it's good. Okay, with that, I'm going to give it back to Roy. It's 10 to 10, so I was on for a little while here. And as I said, to be continued, we have this article continues with transmission line stubs. And then my favorite, which is antenna feed point matching. They'll be talking about gamma match, beta or hairpin match, and what else? There's, well, I guess those are the two that he mentions, but there's others, as we all know. So there's T match, there's delta match, and so on. The gamma match, I just mentioned. So there's a bunch of stuff. So we'll continue this. And it'll be good. All right. I hope this brought some light into what coax cables can be used for, other than just connecting your radio to your antenna. Because it does more than just that. Okay, Roy, back to you, and thank you again. And to be continued, AC2GS, WA2CDL, and the TechNet, Andy's Corner. See you later. Ed, Roy, it's all yours.
Andy, thank you very much, and thanks to you.
This is AC2GS. Thank you very much, Andy. It was another good presentation of Andy's Corner. I'm looking forward to next Sunday for the finish of that QST article. I'm kind of surprised that this topic of anti-reflective optical coatings was brought up. That was very interesting. As a fellow photographer, I've seen those coatings. You know, nowadays even inexpensive filters slap on those anti-reflective coatings. So that was interesting that it got brought up in the topic. I want to point out to people that the link page now includes a link to the YouTube video of that AT&T discussion on standing wave reflex, standing wave ratios, and it's an interesting one, as Ed pointed out. It is a bit on the grainy side, but it's very informative. So if you have nothing better to do, go to roy.ac2gs.com after the net and watch the YouTube. It is fascinating.
Confirm that.
We are all in agreement here on that subject. So once again, this is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra. My name is Roy. I am the control operator for this, the Limark Technical Net. If any of you guys have any questions of a technical nature, or topics you want to discuss, or if it's any other field of science that so interests you, or if you want to discuss the present COVID problems we're having, please bring up your topic and we'll try and help as best we can.
Well, if no one else will step up, I have a question about COVID-19. Follow up to one I asked 2 weeks ago, WB2ABC.
Yeah, certainly, Ed. The last one was related to a person's report about viral loads and masks.
Yeah, this is related to that. We're hearing about some decreases, and there's some interesting data that has to do with that a lot of people who are coming down with COVID are saying that they do wear masks a lot. Is there any recent data on that subject? Because I go out eating quite outdoors, and we see people who are very careful, and we see people who are very sloppy. For example, you see a large table with 12 people sitting around it without masks, talking loudly in an outdoor environment, and they think they're doing great. And I think if there are problems that are coming from that, not for people following the rules carefully. Do you have any comment?
Yeah, the problem is that these reports are based upon people's own histories that they give. And people are not, it's not that people lie generally, is that people have a interesting sense of their own reality, if you will. So, there was a study that was weirdly mentioned at one of these, not quite debates, I don't know, town halls, where they did a very small study of a small group of people who had been infected, and among those small number of people, they themselves said, 85% of them said that they used masks. It's problematic. A lot of times when people say that they use masks, that could range all over the place, from people who are doing it religiously to people who are doing it halfway, using it on their chin, lowering it below their nose, moving it around with their hands, moving their hands all over their face. And so it's very difficult with a degree and yet were infected. I mean, ultimately, I'm sure the studies are going to demonstrate that this is not a complete foolproof method, but it does lessen your chances. And in this world where there's no real particularly great antivirals or vaccines yet, that's kind of what we got.
Thank you.
Anyone else with any other questions or topics for tonight, any aspect of science you want? I will mention last week a gentleman asked a question that I really didn't know. I didn't have a clue. He asked about something that he called a silver mica disease. So I looked it up. It is a little bit on the esoteric side. What it amounts to is in the 1950s and I guess to the 60s, things like the All-American Five radios, the five tubes, very inexpensive design, kind of questionable design in that it grounded on the chassis. And it had a polarized plug. So if you plugged it in the wrong way and then touched ground while your hands were anywhere near the back of the chassis, you electrocuted yourself. And I got a shock myself from an All-American Five. But silver mica disease is a situation that radios in that era would have in their IF cages. In addition to the inductor, they would have a capacitor. Very commonly, they would have a silver mica capacitor. And what they would do is electroplate the mica with the silver and put it inside the IF transformer. And under the influence of high voltage in vacuum tube radios, you would have a degree of reverse electroplating, and you would have dendrites form on the silver part of the silver mica capacitor. This would lead to the so-called silver mica disease, which translated in a lot of static or noise, because instead of a nice flat capacitor in the IF transformer, you would have a capacitor with a bunch of spikes that would discharge and produce a lot of static. I don't think, although silver mica capacitors still exist, they're not used, as far as I'm aware, in IF transformers, and most likely you'll see far less of that in common transistor designs, simply because the voltage potentials are not high enough, probably, to form those dendrites. So that's a little answer to last week's question. If the gentleman is listening in the background.
Yes, I am. This is AF2P, but I'm not transmitting.
Okay, well, then it's interesting that I heard you. So I assume that's what you were alluding to. So once again, my understanding is that it was phased out many decades ago, probably around the same time that transistor radios came into their own. but theoretically the dendrite formation would probably not be a problem at the voltage potentials that radios that use solid state as opposed to vacuum tubes use.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I see now where I am transmitting. Yes, thank you. This is AF2B. Name is Ed, and I appreciate your doing the research on that.
WB2EAB has a question on the subject.
Yes, Ed.
There is a military spec on silver mica dipped capacitors. Type CMO5, I guess, is the most common size. I use them in RF circuits all over the place and never heard of this problem. I'm not saying it didn't happen. What I'm saying is either they solved it or they figured out where it happened and it was easy to avoid it. So I'm saying it's not a problem to my knowledge in my career, maybe back in the 30s.
Well, I mean, when you go to do a web search, they talk a lot about American, you know, the AA-5s. So it's probably the 90s, the 1950s and the 1960s. My understanding that military spec silver was really, there's a slightly different way that the military spec silver capacitors worked, in that there was also included some kind of glass material that improved its durability. It made it a little bit more sensitive to vibration. But I think that the military spec silver mica capacitors are slightly different designs than the ones that were inserted into IF cages in radios in the 1950s.
Very possible.
Yeah, I mean, there's also other problems people have seen in silver mica. Sometimes the silver will tarnish and introduce imperfections and lead to other problems. But I think the silver mica disease was primarily the dendrites, in that most people who are discussing it usually don't say that they had a total failure, although eventually they do. It usually starts out as that kind of scratchy bass noise that just kind of comes and goes on these radios. So, fascinating bit of history. Thankfully, most of that is behind us now.
I have another one for you. Purple plague.
Purple plague. I am clueless. What is purple plague?
In the early days of integrated circuits, they used gold for a lot, and there was some kind of a reaction between the gold and some of the semiconductor, doping materials that would cause some corrosion that had this purple, almost like what would be a rash on human skin. And they started calling it purple plague, and that's when they designed gold out of those circuits.
Okay, that's fascinating. I never heard of that. It would be kind of interesting to look up as well to see what was going on with the gold. Gold's usually a relatively stable material, but who knows what kind of magical chemicals they were using in those days.
I should imagine what they used to do doping with. I assume it's some toxic group.
I would assume so. Having been a chemistry major, no one really kind of cared about the toxicity if it did the job right. As a guy who grew up through college exposed to way too many benzene fumes.
Good point.
Yes, indeed. We are in safer times, but this is kind of a general trend. Until society just kind of collapses in on itself. Back in the very old days when X-rays were young, people were putting machines into shoe stores so that you could irradiate your feet and see how your shoes were fitting. We all know how X-rays are loads of fun. When Madame Curie discovered radium and such, nuclear decay products, radioactive material, was considered exciting and new, and they were putting it in all kinds of